This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora, assalamualaikum. Welcome to another episode of Headscarves and Good Yarns. As always, we're really about to get into the meat of things, and hopefully this episode will be food for thought and another way of looking at this world and how we experience it. But a little, little disclaimer slash grounding for this episode, because it's really, really important. What I would love to sink my teeth into today is talking about the struggle. The struggle with being part of being part of a marginalized community, but it's not even specifically that, just the struggle interacting with the many systems in our lives when, you know, you do not have that that power or that privilege. And maybe another disclaimer that goes with that, that this is something that is ever changing. You know, we have so many things that make up who we are, and so many identifiers and experiences and access to power and privilege, like depending on the context, that this will change. But I'm here to say, you know, that the struggle is real, and that specific struggle being the struggle associated when you do not have that power to, or that access to power or privilege. You know, things like structural inequality, that's real. Any of the isms, racism, classism, sexism, ableism, you know, they're not just abstract ideas. You know, these are things that actively shape people's access to safety and health and education and opportunity in very real material ways. So, when we talk about the struggle, it's not just a narrative, it's not a storyline, it's a daily real thing. And so, you know, this episode is not here to deny that or to minimize that. This episode is not here to flatten our differences. This episode is not about saying, you know, everyone struggles in some kind of vague equalizing way that we sometimes hear. What I want to talk about with this episode is what happens when struggle becomes expected, central to identity, and, you know, in many ways romanticized, whether that is done quietly or loudly. And this is what this episode is about. It is not here to then minimize or flatten or deny the existence of the struggle, because it is here, and not everyone has power to, or access to that power and privilege. But what I specifically want to talk about is when that struggle transforms into something else. And I think, you know, it becomes even more problematic when that struggle becomes the main lens or the main way in which marginalized people or communities are seen, understood, and validated. And, you know, the inspiration for this episode, it came across this TikTok that I saw. You know, I was just kind of scrolling, having my usual TikTok scroll, and it was this TikTok about this black woman talking about her life, you know, and the amazing successes that she had, you know, like Ivy League education, high level career, mad stability, mad success. And this TikTok, this woman was kind of talking about how people are always surprised by that. And even in the comments section, you could kind of see that surprise there. So it wasn't like, you know, like, comment section full of celebration. It was filled with surprise. And in the video, this woman was saying, you know, like, my parents are doctors and lawyers. Like, why wouldn't I be successful? And, you know, it's something that is so simple and factual, but it almost kind of felt disruptive because it was being said by black women. And I think there's always this expectation that there is always struggle. But when you really think about it, like, this woman had mad access to power and privileges that come with having very successful parents in fields that are highly respected, highly paid, you know, would open a lot of doors for her. And again, I'm not here to minimize the struggle, but it was more that surprise that this wouldn't even be an option for a black woman. And so I think this is what I really want to get into with this episode, because you know, if you really think about the surprise that this woman receives in her life day to day, but also like in the comments section, the surprise actually isn't specific to her. It's about that expectation associated with black people. And so what I really, really want to like sink our teeth into today is, you know, what happens when marginalized people or communities are only seen as real when they are struggling? And, you know, what happens when suffering becomes the thing that makes someone legible? And, you know, what does that do, not just to perception, but to people? And I think a really good place to kind of start this episode is thinking about the Struggle Olympics. And I think it's something that most people have felt or observed, even if, you know, you don't have a name to it. So what is the Struggle Olympics? It's this quiet, often unspoken hierarchy where suffering gets ranked. And I think a really important like little grounding or disclaimer to put out there is that this doesn't always like look aggressive or like very, what's the word to passive, like active. You know, it often shows up in very socially acceptable, polite ways. You know, like I feel like almost everyone listening has probably heard phrases like, you know, oh, well, you know, at least you didn't go through, that's hard, but imagine, oh, you think that's bad? Try da 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 da. Or sometimes we can even internalize it as well. You know, like, do I even have it bad enough to complain? Other people have it worse. And so, you know, on the surface, it can kind of look like, you know, you're just like a reframe or, you know, perspective taking. But underneath all of that, there is something more structural happening. And suffering kind of low-key becomes a kind of currency. You know, in sociology, psychology, you know, we talk about different forms of capital, right? Not just like straight up cash, but also like social capital, cultural capital, moral capital. And I think, and this is something that I have personally observed in identity-based or progressive spaces. I'm not saying this happens everywhere, but it's just something that I have noticed. Suffering can function or act as some kind of moral capital, right? Because it can give you authority, make your voice harder to challenge, or position your experience as more legitimate. And, you know, I think, you know, nothing in this world ever exists in a vacuum, and this didn't come out of nowhere. You know, historically, marginalized voices were, and you know what, I'm going to say are, because it still very much happens to this day, are dismissed. And so centering lived experience becomes necessary in that context. And I think very valid, because our systems and powers of structure, one of the reasons why they are galvanized and that status quo is maintained is because marginalized voices are completely dismissed, ignored, made redundant, drowned out by the stories and the narrative and the priorities that the system chooses and prioritizes. So in that case, centering lived experience is really important and really valid. When that happens, it really shatters that illusion that this is the normal, you know, even though you can't see me, I'm saying this in air quotes, the normal way of viewing and experiencing the world. And there are other worldviews and perspectives and values that are important. And not everyone experiences our world the same way that you do. But I think what's happening when struggle is kind of changed into some kind of moral capital, that sharing and centering of lived experience, it changes into a hierarchy. And so, you know, now it's not just what have you experienced, which I think is a really important question when you center lived experience. It becomes, you know, that question transforms into, does your experience count enough? And, you know, there's research on this, and it's called competitive victimhood, where, you know, it can be on an individual level, it can be groups or like community level, emphasize their suffering relative to others to gain recognition or moral standing. And you see this everywhere. You know, you see this in, you know, online and comment thread sections where people argue whose oppression is worse. You see it not just in the online space, in real life, when people shut down conversations or shut down, you know, even having an open mind to think about what other people are going through, because someone else has it harder. And I think when this happens, it's also really hard to get into the headspace of like accepting that multiple things can be true at the same time. And, you know, what I was saying before about how our power and privilege, it can change depending on context, you know, that is very complicated and nuanced, and so many things can be true at the same time. For that, it's, I think, when you are, you know, critically thinking and feeling about how you view the world, how you experience the world, and kind of taking into consideration other people's experience and kind of investigating our systems and our power structures, you know, things are not going to be black and white. It's going to be multiple shades of gray that kind of exist all at the same time, even if one shade of gray seems like it's going to cancel out another shade of gray. And so when people get to that space where they're shutting down conversations, you're also shutting down that opportunity to even play with holding multiple truths at the same time. And you see this in when competitive victimhood happens, you know, even in activism spaces, you know, where proximity to trauma becomes some kind of form of authority, where it's like, okay, well, you know, their experience is the worst, and so they are the best, the go-to person, the best person to talk about things. And I know I'm always bringing up bell hooks, but I think, you know, what bell hooks has said is really relevant here. You know, in All About Love, and actually across all of her mahi, she reminds us that systems of domination don't disappear, they get reproduced. So instead of dismantling this hierarchy, which is the aim of centering and sharing lived experience, we rebuild it. But, you know, this time it's not based on like power or privilege or wealth, it's based on suffering. And, you know, we need to get so real about this, because it has very real emotional consequences. You know, if your legitimacy is tied to struggle, then, you know, what happens when things get better? You know, you might downplay your success, you know, you emphasize your hardship, you might feel guilty for having stability. You know, if we kind of think about the, you know, quote unquote, real world, you know, when we think about reality TV or just any kind of social media storytelling, you know, I'm not going to put the emphasis on contestants or creators. I'm also going to say producers, and by extension, us, the consumers, you know, often have their hardest life experience highlighted. And actually, I feel like highlighted is a really, like, passive way of saying it. It's like literally shoved down our throats, especially with some of these reality TV shows, because that is really what we attach ourselves to. But then that person becomes really one-dimensional. Like, as I'm saying this, I'm just thinking about the latest Love is Blind season that came out, and I've already forgotten what city it was. But side note, the usual Love is Blind messiness very much happened on this episode. But actually lots of sparks for like real good conversations, like unpacking that season with some of my like good friends. We were talking about like the politics of dating preferences and just the values of politics and how that is relatable when you're trying to find your person. But anyways, always going on a side tangent here. There was this particular contestant and they had, now forgive me if I'm remembering this incorrectly, but they had some kind of genetic condition, which meant that they had, lots of surgeries when they were really young, and so that led to like mass scarring on their arm, and it was brought up a lot. Like, dare I say, every episode, and it really like reduced this person to just this one thing about them. And the struggle very much became part of their story in a very like on purpose conditioned way, which is strange. So, you know, there's this element of like the struggle Olympics and the competitive victimhood, and how that can lead to us really seeing each other in one-dimensional ways. And so there's this element of like comparing struggle, but I think with this kōrero, it goes even deeper than that. And you know, it's when we expect that struggle to happen. And you know, when we expect that struggle, whether we realize this consciously or not, there is a script that we carry around about certain people, certain communities. And, you know, once you see it, you see the script everywhere. And if you are marginalized, you know, your life is expected to include visible struggle. And this script is reinforced constantly. You know, if you think about films like, you know, 12 Years a Slave or Slumdog Millionaire, which were powerful and important stories, and stories that were about, you know, suffering. It's centered on that only. You know, even like movies like The Pursuit of Happiness, again, like the struggle is central to the narrative arc. And now that we're talking about this, like, can, in your mind, of course, can you think of many movies or books or just any form of storytelling where marginalized communities, or, you know, people of colour communities or black communities, stories that we're told that are not centred on struggle or suffering. And I don't think that list is going to be very long. You know, there's so many other stories that are missing, that are outside the script that we are all carrying. You know, stories of success that isn't framed as overcoming hardship, or, you know, even those stories of like stable middle class lives, or, you know, generational wealth in marginalized communities. Because, you know, despite the script we carry, it would make you believe that this doesn't happen, but it very much does. So when these stories do appear, they are treated as exceptional. Like, think about the reaction to the show Black-ish, which was, you know, a black upper middle class family, and it was seen as like groundbreaking and refreshing. But, you know, why should it be that surprising? And, you know, wealthy or well-do black families have been here, you know, so why should that be surprising? And, you know what, this is where I think our man James Baldwin says something that's quite important to this part of the corridor. In The Fire Next Time, James Baldwin talks about how societies construct narratives to maintain order. So if the script or the narrative is that marginalized people struggle, then hey-ho, inequality feels natural, hierarchy feels justified, and success, it feels like an exception. And you can see this in like real life, you know, like when you know, people from marginalized communities, you know, when they are professionals, being called articulate. This has happened to me as a Muslim woman, being told that you're not like other Muslim women. You know, when immigrants are being praised for being hardworking in ways that imply others are not. And it, you see this like in pop culture as well. You just think about like POC, you know, people of color celebrities. And specifically, I'm going to talk about Zendaya. You know, she often gets framed as graceful, articulate, different, and underlying that, all those adjectives, is the expectation that she is exceeding. And I think, you know, well, Zendaya is all of those things, but I think expectation bias plays a role here, because those three words are not really used for other POC celebrities, specifically black female celebrities. And so, you know, if you expect struggle, you interpret reality through that lens. And so success becomes surprising, stability becomes invisible, and nuance gets erased entirely. And I think, you know, another element to this that's really important to talk about, class, because there are wealthy black families. There are highly educated immigrant households. You know, there is generational privilege within marginalized groups. But these, you know, stories, they really, and experiences, they disrupt that script and that narrative that we're being told. And so that they're less visible. You know, I'm just thinking back to that TikTok that I saw. You know, it was clear that this person came from a wealthy, highly educated black household, but that is not what's expected if you follow the script. And that's dangerous when struggle is seen as the only story. You know, when struggle kind of becomes that dominant narrative, people stop being seen as individuals and they start being seen as stories, and specifically stories of suffering. And another great thinker, Aisha Akambi, really criticizes this, you know, the flattening of identity into fixed roles. So, you know, if we look at Hollywood, for example, films about black life that receive critical acclaim, they often center trauma. You know, you think about Moonlight, you think about Precious. I had to take a pause there because I watched Precious and I read the book that that movie was based on, and it is heavy. So, you know, yeah, it is so true that films about black life that receive that level of critical acclaim all center trauma. And again, I'm not here to say those are not important stories, but just really contrast that with how rare it is to see black luxury without struggle, immigrant wealth without a trauma backstory. And, you know, if we think about other immigrant communities, like if migrant communities, you know, even when these stories exist, like Crazy Rich Asians, they're framed or seen as like novel or surprising or finally. And I think that finally it's telling us something, you know, it's revealing that absence. And social media like really amplifies all of this. You know, there are so many posts about trauma and hardship and vulnerability that get more engagement. And so that really reaffirms that script, you know, pain equals visibility. And it's just this feedback loop that's just being reinforced, which is pain leading to attention or critical claim. There's repetition, and then that just affirms that perception. And as a result of that, you know, people and communities become flattened into narratives, into symbols, into digestible versions of themselves. And, you know, these are scripts and narratives that are easier to simplify and consume, but are harder to, you know, see as equals or to share power with. And I think if we get really, 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 really real about all of this, and it's something that I have personally seen in the activism space, is this struggle as the only way that this person or this community can exist or be seen. This dynamic is often reinforced by, you know, people who see them as allies. And there's a word to this. It's called trauma consumption. And this is where people are drawn to stories of suffering because they evoke strong emotional responses. And, you know, these responses, they feel meaningful. You know, there's a lot of empathy and awareness and feeling morally aligned. But this feeling is not action. It's not the same as action. And I think, you know, what James Baldwin was saying before really comes in quite sharply again, because, you know, in The Fire Next Time, he makes this a really important argument that awareness without action changes very little, you know, and it's something that we see a lot in our world right now, you know, when it comes to movements, brands posting solidarity statements, but not really changing any internal practices. You know, when there are like influencers or creators or celebrities speaking on justice issues while still benefiting from the same systems. Or, you know, when we engage deeply with storytelling that centers suffering but not supporting structural change. You know, just while I'm talking about this, I actually haven't properly watched the show, but I feel like because there's so much about it online, I feel like I have like secondhand watched the show. You know, shows like Euphoria, which, you know, I know it's not about marginalization in the same way that we're talking about in this episode, it still very much shows how audiences are just drawn to intense suffering and trauma narratives. because it's so visceral and raw in that show, for all the different characters and in different ways. And I'm yet to watch this new season, but I have, you know, seen what the storylines are, and it is very much a lot of intense suffering and trauma narratives, and so there's this emotional pull, right? And this pull can kind of create a false sense of comfort of like, I care, I understand, I'm aware. But awareness alone does not dismantle systems, and romanticizing struggle can make that inaction easier. You know, it's really easy to kind of stop at that awareness. Because, you know, if struggle is meaningful and inspiring and inevitable, then it becomes something to witness and not to eliminate. And another thing that I want to say when we're just kind of talking about how this dynamic is often reinforced by people who see themselves as allies, something that I have also seen in the activism spaces that I have moved in, this struggle Olympics, and people like this can happen for many different reasons and many contexts, but just for whatever the context or the reason is, what I have observed is, you know, whether there's a particular kaupapa and people who wanting to be allies and not directly part of the community that that kaupapa is about, you know, then turning it into a struggle or victim Olympics to kind of legitimatize their presence in that kaupapa, when really what should be happening is, you know, being an ally in the verb sense, not in label or identity sense. And part of that is acknowledging, like, whose voices and lived experience need to be prioritized in this moment and in this kaupapa. But instead it's turned to some weird kind of struggle Olympics. It is, I know you can't see me right now, but I'm just shaking my head because it's so bizarre to me. But I think it's really easy for that to happen when the struggle for certain people and communities are so embedded in how we look into the world that we in ourselves have dehumanized people. And when that happens, it's a slippery slope, because even if you mean well, you can recreate those systemic harms. So there are so many consequences to romanticizing or centering the struggle to this extent. You know, like, first of all, normalization. You know, if the struggle is expected, it stops feeling urgent. It doesn't feel like, you know, we need to rally around this. We need to dismantle systems. We need to make noise for change. If it's expected, it stops feeling urgent. And I think that is dangerous, because it kind of lulls us into this false sense of security that if it's not urgent, then nothing needs to be done. Or on the other end of it, if it stops feeling urgent, then doing like performative activism then feels even more valid, in the sense that, oh, we've done this, it feels like we've really helped out and we've done our part. So I really think we need to push back on that normalization. Another consequence of this romanticizing the struggle is, you know, when struggle becomes inspiring or beautiful or character building, it really can bleed into identity the same way in fitness culture no pain, no gain is normalized, or in hustle culture, struggle now, enjoy later. It's almost as if the struggle becomes this kind of aesthetic, and when it becomes an aesthetic, it really bleeds into identity. And when it bleeds into identity to that level, we are very much dehumanizing people and communities. Another thing as well to be mindful of when we are talking about romanticizing the struggle is identity traps, because if your identity is tied to struggle, then, you know, thriving can feel like losing your story or losing connection or becoming other in your own community. And it's really easy to kind of internalize it. I think that's something that I did. I just remember growing up and being so... I was like, you know, when you're... Well, this is, you know, I try to give myself grace, but it's like when you're a kid, you're like a sponge and you just soak up everything around you. And the way that, you know, here in Aotearoa, the way that we talk about Africa and Somalia, I really just did not think it was possible for, you know, my people to be successful or to be wealthy or to be just like thriving in that sense, to have that like level of success. And, you know, I think I felt like that because the struggle was just so, that struggle and the trauma of a civil war and famine was just so like centered and romanticized that it really played with how I perceived myself and my people. And it wasn't until I really, you know, started undoing the knots and really re-looking at the lens in which I view this world. And, you know, side note, that is something that is going to be lifelong. It's not a one and done. I've realized that actually, I think I really put this idea into my mind that struggle and trauma was associated with my people and success is associated with whiteness. And then, you know, I really was like, actually, that scale is not true. And what happened to my country is the awful circumstances of what happens when a country goes through civil war and famine. You know, prior to that, of course success existed in Somalia. Of course wealthy families existed in Somalia. But I think that was completely obscured from me with the lens that in which I was viewing this world prior to, you know, me kind of unstitching that. And so it's really easy to kind of internalize that twisted way of thinking about struggle. And thank goodness I don't think like that anymore. And when, you know, when it does become like so internalized, it's really easy to like emphasize hardship or feel uncomfortable with ease or downplay success. And of course, like, there's an element of imposter syndrome that's happening here, this individual imposter syndrome, but there's also this structural level of imposter syndrome as well. And so, you know, if you've been told that, you know, people that look like you or are from your community struggle, so when you don't have that struggle, or when you kind of do level up in life, it feels like you're an exception, or you feel unstable in that success, or you wait for things to fall apart. And, you know, when I think about what is the antidote to this romanticizing or expecting the struggle, or when it becomes central to identity, the antidote to this is really liberation. And not just the absence of struggle, but the absence of needing it to be valid. And, you know, our girl Bell Hooks, she talks about love as a practice of freedom in her book, And All About Love. And I think this freedom in this case can look like, you know, being ordinary, being complex, being fully human, and not just a story of survival. So if we're trying to move away from romanticizing the struggle, you know, then what? If we move away from defining people or communities by struggle, if we stop centering pain as the main narrative, if we allow marginalized people to exist outside of suffering, you know, we're kind of left in a really, you know, uncomfortable position, which is, you know, what replaces that? And, you know, as Bell Hooks was saying, I think that freedom can be found in being ordinary, being complex, being fully human. I think liberation lies there. But this is, I think, where the kōrero gets quieter, but also deeper, because it is one thing to critique a system, but it's also another thing to kind of sit in what's left when that thing is gone. And, you know, I think struggle, when it's romanticized to this point, it gives us a very clear narrative, right? And it's all surrounded around hardship, and it's neat, it's linear, it's satisfying. And when I say neat, I'm meaning neat as in it's tidy, not it's neat. That's great. Just to clarify. And it's also really easy to understand, and it's easy to expect that. And I think this is why you see it time and time again in films and books and social media storytelling. But real life is not neat. We are humans. We are complex, and multiple things can be true at the same time. And so when you kind of remove the tidiness and expectation that comes when we do romanticize the struggle, you know, what we're left with is messiness and contradiction and ambiguity. And so, you know, because in reality, what it's most of the time really like is that, you know, people are sometimes privileged, sometimes marginalized, sometimes thriving, sometimes struggling, sometimes powerful, sometimes vulnerable. And that is a lot harder to package, and a lot harder to consume, and a lot harder to explain. And I think, you know, we as a society prefer scripts or clean narratives. Like, we all like to know who is good, who is bad, who are the ones who suffer, who are the ones that overcome. But reality does not give us that clarity. And so, you know, when marginalized people don't fit into that struggle trauma, resilience narrative, it can create discomfort, but it only creates discomfort because we now have to engage with people as full people and not symbols and stories. And that then asks more of us. It asks us to dismantle that script that we carry and really investigate, like, where does that story come from? Why is it so easy to swallow that story and to carry it around? And that's a space that we need to be getting to. So when we do come across suffering, we see it through the lens of what it really is and not through the lens of, like, expecting it or romanticizing it. And another thing that we're going to have to get used to, I think, kind of moving away from this and finding that freedom, is the loss of moral simplicity. Because, you know, struggle kind of gives people moral clarity. You know, we know how to respond. You know, if someone is suffering, we know how to respond. But what happens when someone is successful or powerful or thriving and marginalized? The response is not clear. And so now we have to get really comfortable with holding multiple truths at the same time. You know, someone can experience racism and still have class privilege. Someone can be marginalized in one way and dominant in another. Someone can be both vulnerable and powerful. And that complexity is uncomfortable because it really disrupts that idea that marginalized people are always victims. And it forces a realistic conversation about power. And, you know, you really see this play out in with public figures. You know, when you talk about someone like Oprah Winfrey, you know, she is a black woman who has navigated racism and sexism, but also at the same time, she is one of the most powerful and wealthy media figures in the world. So how do people talk about her? I've noticed, you know, when people talk about Oprah, I was trying to combine her first and last names there. They often oscillate between centering her struggle and completely just, like, denying or ignoring her successes and the level of wealth that she has. Or they talk about her by critiquing her power. They can never talk about the same, both at the same time. And that's because it asks us to have nuance. But that nuance is harder than the narrative that is being supported right now. And I think another way that we can look at rejecting this narrative is just thinking about how we consume storytelling, because struggle is a lot more marketable than stability. You know, if you think about viral posts and documentaries and memoirs, like, it's those stories of hardships that are very compelling. And I'm not here to say that you're not allowed to engage with content like that at all and to boycott it, but just think about, like, you know, what voices are being centered in those, you know, viral stories, and how can you ensure you're consuming it in a way that doesn't flatten these people or communities into one dimension. And I'm just speaking from just me being a Māo. If I were to ever write an autobiography or to ever be a public facing figure, I would feel this immense pressure about, you know, centering my, you know, valid, don't get me wrong, valid experiences of navigating the system. And so centering my lived experience and centering, I suppose, the trauma with that to be seen as important. And I think that even I'm feeling this pressure, I'm not even a public facing figure of like tell your pain or risk being invisible. But then I also do not want to contribute to that romanticized struggle, because my being is way more than just, you know, the struggle. And I, you know, my me being Muslim and my blackness, there are other ways of experiencing that that's outside of struggle. And I don't want to contribute. I wouldn't want to contribute to that. To that struggle is expected with black people, because I don't want to further feed that script, and to make myself legible through pain, or to shape all of my life stories around hardship, because that's not what it is. That's not the full truth of my life. But it is like, again, I'm not a public facing person at all, but I just, even thinking about this hypothetical situation, it creates pressure. And so I think we need to consume in a way that doesn't feed into this, but I just allow people to share their full truths of their lives and not just have it kept in certain containers. And I think another thing is that like identity without struggle can feel like a void, if it's internalized. You know, who am I? Where do I belong? What connects me to others? And so I think we need to allow people to be their full selves and feel and express their full humanity, so we can talk about the struggle and center lived experiences, but not with romanticizing it and not without the hierarchy. And I think we need to allow all people, regardless of their various identities, to exist in normalcy and messiness and humor. I think that is quite radical, because it allows people to be their full selves. And so the goal there isn't to erase struggle from the narrative, but to decenter in a way where it's, you know, part of the story but not the entire story. And it allows people to be humans, you know, to be complicated and to be evolving. And so, because I think the most honest and most human thing is that not every life is a clean narrative, but not every identity needs a struggle to make sense. And so I think, you know, the question we should be asking ourselves isn't who has struggled the most, but why do we need struggle to understand people at all? And what would it look like to let people exist without needing pain to make them feel real? And I think if we were moving towards those questions more, if we think back to the video that sparked this whole episode, maybe there wouldn't be surprise when you hear of a black woman being highly successful, when it's clear because of her parents that she has certain accesses to power and privilege, and perhaps struggle hasn't appeared in her life the way that we expect it to in black lives that the script tells us to. Thank you for tuning into another episode of Headscarves and Good Yarns, and catch you for the next one.
Thank you for tuning in into another episode of Headscarves and Good Yarns. To keep spinning the yarns, let us know your thoughts. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Headscarves and Good Yarns, or email us at headscarvesandgoodyarn@gmail.com.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.